Okay, thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, back in Santa Barbara. Always have such a nice time in this institute. I would like to start out with an apology, because in the announcement for this seminar, there were actually two mistakes, one of which was not my fault and one of which was my fault. The mistake that was not my fault is the name of my company. It's Exxon Mobil, one of these corporate compound words that has become so common in this age of globalization and corporate mergers. The second mistake, which was my responsibility, is the title is The World in a Grain of Sand. That is a misquotation from William Blake. The actual quotation is A World in a Grain of Sand, which is actually much more appropriate. And in fact, I looked up the entire quote, which I'd like to read to you. To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. And I like that because I think it expresses in a way the aesthetic of all small physics and all tabletop physics. So that's the correct way to think about a world in a grain of sand. Okay, so I'm supposed to tell you about granular physics. Granular physics is a kind of funny field because it's actually a regime more than a subfield of physics. Normally, we think about granular physics as a regime of separated particles with short range interactions, where you really have two criteria that fix the regime. The first criteria is that the characteristic energy scale of the packing, which you might say is, for instance, in a gravitationally dominated system, mv times v, should be much greater than kT, so that these packings are athermal. This implies, incidentally, that not only are the systems we're talking about non-equilibrium, they are far out of equilibrium. Basically, the granular systems that we deal with are pretty much always far out of equilibrium systems, unlike many of the condensed matter systems, indeed many of the condensed matter non-equilibrium systems that we deal with, which are in some sense actually rather close to equilibrium. The second criterion is that if you look at the Young's modulus of the particles, these should be much greater than the stress tensor, the granular stress tensor in the system, which, for instance, again, in a gravitationally dominated system, you might suppose to be of order the density of the system, the times a characteristic scale, a macroscopic scale in the system. And this is really a requirement that the particles be rigid. So the first thing we can ask is, well, you know, if we go down to the beat, how good are these two criterions in terms of establishing the regime of the system we actually see working on the beach? And the answer is pretty good. Both of these are probably in the range 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th, as far as how much bigger the left-hand side is than the right-hand side. This may be a little bit better, an approximation for a lot of materials in this one, but they're still both pretty good. Would argue that one has to be very careful about this situation, this criterion, because many of the mechanical problems that one can pose with perfectly rigid systems are in fact ill-posed problems. So in the case of this criterion, more than in this case of this criterion, we might expect that the small parameter, which is the stress tensor divided by the Young's modulus, might actually be a singular perturbation on the system. Okay, now, I told you that because of this criterion, these systems are always far out of equilibrium. Nevertheless, the other thing you will notice if you go down to the beach locally, besides the fact that the particles are not really engaging in any appreciable thermal motion, is that nevertheless the packing of the particles is quite random. And this has driven one of the major themes in the study of granular systems, which is there some sense in which equilibrium statistical mechanical ideas can be used to describe the properties of granular media, and if so, under what circumstances, and what is the limit of, I actually don't see it there. Is there some limit of what are the cases where this breaks down and all of that? And this is a subject of, if one might largely call, in the case of granular gases, low-density systems, granular kinetic theory, which is basically an extension of traditional kinetic theory with the kinds of molecular chaos assumptions built into traditional kinetic theory to systems of inelastic frictional particles, and also ideas that you might call granular statistical mechanics, which are variously related either to the same concepts like the entropy of a packing or to analogies between various transitions that occur in granular materials and other disordered transitions that we are familiar with in condensed matter physics, such as the glass transition. And so, if you like, this kind of contradiction or paradox that we have an athermal system which is nevertheless highly disordered drives the intellectual program of people who seek to accommodate granular physics within the ambit of statistical physics overall. There is a second paradox, if you like, which drives a second broad theme of research in granular physics, which is the fact that there is, in fact, a shortage of dimensionless groups in granular problems, particularly in granular dynamics problems. In ordinary hydrodynamics, there are objects like the viscosity that appear that determine length scales, which are comfortably intermediate between the microscopic atomic length scales of, for instance, a fluid, and the macroscopic length scales on which we are interested in the behavior of the system. Such intermediate length scales tend to be missing, or at least superficially tend to be missing when you look at the dynamics of granular systems. And the line of research that has evolved to deal with these problems I would call granular fluid and solid mechanics. Is just as this is devoted to trying to understand how these concepts of statistical physics can be applied, taking advantage of the fact that we have a disordered system. Here we want to apply the traditional concepts of solid elasticity or hydrodynamics adapted suitably for granular materials, despite the fact that we lack some of the averaging length scales that are characteristic in traditional problems, and also, again, the fact that granular fluid and solid mechanics, as we normally teach them to our students, or you normally teach them to your students, I'm not in that business anymore, is actually very close to equilibrium theory, basically, and therefore we have to weigh both problems here. Okay? Okay, so that's kind of the overall paradoxes that face the field. There are also a number of other physical issues that one needs to be aware of in thinking about granular material. Physical issues that can really rise up and bite the theorists in this field if he or she is not aware of them. A lot of what physics does is it tries to describe the macroscale properties of materials from a fundamental microscopic picture. And the fundamental microscopic theory that underlies granular mechanics has a name, and the name is contact mechanics. Which is the branch of elasticity theory which deals with typically small contact between solid bodies where the average force is being exerted across the contact is small in the appropriate dimensionless sense with respect to the Young's modulus of the system. And so contact mechanics is a very old and distinguished branch of engineering mechanics. But it's, in fact, quite a complicated branch, and in many respects, rather poorly understood. And there are some fundamental questions in contact mechanics, some fundamental computations that you would like to be able to do in contact mechanics, which, in fact, have not been done, and to a certain extent, remain open problems. And so to illustrate the complexity, I'd like to take a moment and talk about the first example, which is the history dependence of contact. Okay. I'm emphasizing this because this is, despite my statement that, which I think is true, that contact mechanics is the fundamental microscopic theory underlying granular physics, it's actually a relatively poorly understood part of mechanics to most physicists, with the exception of a few classic calculations, such as the Hertzian calculation. So we're going to consider two spherical elastic particles subjected to a normal force N, and under the influence of this normal force, a circular contact will form between the particles, and there will be various deformations internal to the particles. And now we are going to provide an additional loading to this system. We're going to load with a tangential force T, which will cause the centers of the particles to move transversely with respect to one another by a distance y. Now, we suppose that there is a microscopic Coulombic coefficient of friction between these particles at the surface such that there is a maximum tangential force equal to this coefficient of friction times the normal force that can be exerted at this contact. So, the history of loading of this contact can be expressed by, here is the failure line T equals mu n, and any particular history of loading of the contact can be expressed by a trajectory in the Tn plane. However, if you think about what's going on, actually, different physical parts of the surfaces of the two particles are brought into contact with one another depending on the precise history of the loading of this contact. So if you load in this way or if you load in this way, you actually have different parts of the contact, you know, different parts of the surface in contact with one another, and you find that quantities such as the compliance, the derivative of T with respect to Y vary with the loading history. Okay? This is the subject. This has actually been worked out in detail for the case of particles with zero Poisson ratio, in which limit a great deal of beautiful analytic theory has been done by Nimlin and Drizowitz. And it's an interesting sociological comment that this paper, which anticipates many of the developments in condensed matter physics in the later part of the 20th century, bar theories of Barkhausen noise, and other problems where you have to understand what are the elements of the history of a system that can be erased by changing the loading history. This paper was written in the 50s and has essentially not led to a large subsequent literature in the history of contact mechanics, basically because they completely solved the only problem that was analytically soluble. Okay, so that's the first example. The second example is computing rolling friction. Okay, so if you now take these same configurations and you do not shear the particles with respect to one another, but you roll them over one another, it is generally the case that there is dissipation. And the reason there is dissipation is because you can show that you will always exceed the Coulomb criterion at the trailing edge of a rolling contact. So if we now look at a contact not inside view as here, but in plan view, so this is the actual circular patch of the contact between the two particles, there is some region at the back of this contact which is basically not rolling, but is always kind of grinding along the surface below it. And this is true for any coefficient of friction mu that is not infinite. For the case of two spherical particles in contact, where you have a circular contact, the shape of this region is unknown, and therefore we are not able to determine the macroscopic rolling friction as a function of the microscopic coefficient of friction, even for this simplest and extremely idealized case. Okay. This is the experiment you can easily perform. If you blow up a balloon and you roll a balloon over a table, there's a squeaking noise, which is basically a stick slip, which is coming from the trailing edge of the contact between the balloon and the table. There's typically a velocity weakening region, and so you hear a stick slip motion that comes from the trailing edge of the contact.
Why is it the trailing edge?
Basically, what the form of this computation, which was also done by Nimlin and Drizowitz, was that they assume that that you are not slipping, and then they compute the normal force, the tangential force locally at the surface, and they show that the tangential force diverges at the trailing edge of the contact. And so that's why the shape isn't exactly known. That you know it's there, but you have an argument by contradiction that shows you that it's there. So it's not a constructive argument. Yes.
The macroscopic view, you're not going down to atomic forces. It's still some phenomenological thing with the coefficient of friction.
Yes.
You're just adding in deformation.
Right. The only thing in here in these calculations is linear elasticity plus a criterion at the surface that the tangential traction at the surface is less than or equal to mu, some coefficient times the normal loading at the surface. Okay. So. I mean, mechanics is full of problems that you would think would have been solved, that nobody's been able to solve. It's a beautiful field. Okay. So, now these are the kinds of physical issues that we know about, and we kind of want to be there in our granular systems because it's part of what makes them granular. And in addition to issues of friction between particles, this also includes inelasticity of the particles. And people use various viscoelastic approaches to determine the elasticity of the particles. And I should comment that the most common kind of high school physics model for inelasticity is the coefficient of restitution, which is just that in any collision between two particles, you lose a finite fraction of the energy of the particles. That's actually a pretty crummy model for the way inelasticity actually works. Inelasticity is strongly velocity dependent in real systems. Unfortunately, the kind of viscoelastic theory that you generate, while better, still does not completely account for what seems to happen in the collision of particles either. And probably surface roughness is playing plasticity, are playing significant and poorly understood roles as well. Okay. So, continuing on my list, I've already mentioned surface roughness. Another phenomenon that plays an important role is interstitial fluids. So interstitial fluids can be one phase, like air or water, or they can be two phase. In which case you tend to get capillary dominated systems. So in fact, the granular systems that are of interest to us in the oil and gas industry are often have two-phase interstitial fluids. And there'll be a quiz at the end of the seminar about what the other phase is. The granular fluid that's the system that's down on the beach here is also a two-phase system because it's quite humid on the beach, so you find a great deal of capillary bridges between the particles, which accounts for the fact that you're able to build sand castles because it makes them more cohesive material. Non-sphericity, okay, which even aside from the fact that particles have rough surfaces, they often in natural systems are not anything like spherical. If you look at quartz particles, they tend to be quite faceted and to be rather prismatic in shape. And this has a lot of, for the most part, not well explored effects on the response of the material. Partly because it's really a nuisance to simulate this numerically. A lot of our knowledge of granular systems comes about because they are relatively simple systems to simulate numerically, emphasis on relatively. People who do it will tell you that relatively still means a lot of work and a lot of potential to make mistakes. But when you move away from spheres to elliptical particles, you need to use ellipsoidal particles, you need to use different kinds of methods, which are much slower and tend to result in systems that simply aren't big enough. This is an issue that's recently gotten some publicity because of the work of Paul Chaykin and Sal Porcato at Princeton, and they were working on the M&M problem, which is basically what is the volume fraction of a packing of M&Ms, and in general, what's the volume fraction of packings of ellipsoids as a function of the aspect ratio of the ellipsoids. And what they claim is that there are ellipsoidal shapes for which the volume fraction of a random packing of ellipsoid is higher than the volume fraction of an ordered packing of spheres. This is kind of a remarkable fact about geometry if it's true. Paul Chaykin actually also has discovered that M&Ms are the most perfect ellipsoid that is commercially available from the candy industry, And he visited the Mars company in Pennsylvania, visited their factory, but they would not admit him to the factory floor so that he could figure out how it was that they were able to make such perfect ellipsoids. And then the final, so these are all of the things that you really want to be concerned about to do with angular physics. For experimentalists, there are a number of other problems that are that can appear that you don't want to be there and you want to get rid of typically. And those typically have to do with the presence of long-range interactions. So the presence of electrostatic and van der Waals interactions are what move you out of what you would call the granular regime into what you would call a powder regime, which is typically seen for smaller particles and is also of interest in industry, but in different industries and are interested in the granular regime. Okay. So the overall situation here is one that I would characterize as very weak or possibly even non-existent universality. The despite the prejudices with which physicists arrived in this subject from a number of decades on working on other types of condensed matter problems, many of the quantitative and even qualitative properties of granular systems depend on things like the surface roughness of the particles to a degree that surprised the practitioners in this field. I think we simply have to accept that that's the nature of granular systems, and it's probably if what you really like to do is compute critical exponents to a high degree of accuracy, this may not be the field of physics for you. However, I think there is a realistic goal that physicists in this field can contribute to. And I actually like the quotation from William Blake. I wrote it down, so I'll read it as I wrote it, which is, build robust, microscopically well-founded phenomenologies that can be easily calibrated against observation and experiments. Okay. Now that's the words are carefully chosen. Because a robust phenomenology, if you go into the engineering literature in these subjects, you'll actually find many robust phenomenologies. Engineers are very good at building robust phenomenologies for the systems with which they have to deal. And in fact, some would claim they're better than physicists at it. So this is just now my kind of personal, opinionated hobby horse here. But I think that physicists who tried to approach this from a purely phenomenological point of view have had to deal with the fact that this is, there's a community out there that's been doing that for a while and is pretty good at it. So it's hard to really change the direction of the cruise liner in that way. However, the words I used in the statement were microscopically well-founded phenomenologies. I think what physicists are good at is moving from scale to scale. And where physicists can really have an impact on these kinds of problems is through thinking through in detail how you move from microscopic pictures, you know, which can be as much or as little contact mechanics appropriate for the problem you're concerned with, to phenomenologies that maybe you can't compute from the microscopics everything, but the structure is robust and the structure is microscopically realistic. And I can tell you that I've seen many cases where that kind of approach to these kinds of complex problems yields real dividends in terms of our level of understanding and of our ability to perform computations relevant to natural and experimental systems. Okay, so that is the somewhat long and over-philosophical overview. I would now like to give you more of an idea of what I'm talking about by going through two examples of problems that are current problems of vital research interest in the granular physics community and which will certainly attract a great deal of attention over the weeks to come. Okay? So the first is in the area of what you might call liquid physics, or fluid mechanics, and in particular to do with free surface flows. Okay. So, the simplest free surface flow of a granular system is what's called a chute flow. Okay, so a chute flow is a flow down an inclined plane, you find an angle theta, of a granular material, and it's characterized by the height of the flow, h. Okay? So that's a pretty simple system. And you might think that this is, for instance, would be a model of a debris flow and as a geophysical flow, when you have just rocks rolling down the hill on top of one another, perhaps more or less of the same size, which actually sometimes happens, but more usually doesn't in natural debris flows. So there is a phase diagram for this flow, which has been seen experimentally by the group of Poulikan and numerically, subsequently, actually, by the group of Gary Grest, a study in which we participated. So what they see is that there are basically three types of behaviors. I'm going to put another dash line here, and I'll tell you in a moment what that dash line is. There's a region in which there is no flow. There are values of h and theta for which, you know, if you prepared the system with those values, you could never get it flowing. You simply will never observe flow at those values of h and theta. There's a region of steady state flow. In which it is possible to prepare a system so that the dissipation, which will be arising from the inelasticity and the friction between the particles, is exactly balancing the gravitational work that is being done on the system. And finally, there is a regime of accelerating flow, and in this regime, basically the further down the chute you go, the faster it's going. You are really failing to dissipate as much energy as you are creating in the system by the gravitational work you do. This line, which is the lower boundary of the region of steady state flow, is sometimes called the angle of repose line, because it's the line at which a flow will stop if you are, for instance, lowering the value of theta. The dashed line, which I put in, I'm not really going to talk about here, but I'm putting it in there to give you a hint that things are always a little bit more complicated than as exposed in a one-hour seminar. And this is the critical angle line. And that's at the line at which flow initiates if you increase theta. And so you see that there's actually a region of hysteresis in these flows. Okay? Now, in the steady state flow regime, the rheology is characterized by the so-called Poulikan flow rule, and again, I think it's a remarkable, and it's a credit to Olivier Poulikan that this flow rule was actually first observed in an experiment and only subsequently observed in simulations. And this flow rule is that the Froude number of the flow, which is the average downslope velocity divided by the square root of gh, is equal to a function of h divided by h stop of theta, which is just the angle of the repose line, And this function can be approximated by the form constant times h over h stop minus gamma. And here you already begin to see some of the significant differences. For sand, beta and gamma are both approximately 0.07. And for glass beads, beta is approximately 0.14 and gamma is approximately 0. So if you look at this formula, what that says is that for sand, as h goes to h stop, the right-hand side of this expression is still finite. So for sand, you go from a finite velocity to 0 at this line. No, that's for glass beads. For glass beads, you go from a finite velocity to 0 at this line. Whereas for sand, at least approximately, the velocity is going to 0 at this line. So this is an entirely different behavior, which has significant implications, incidentally, for the instabilities of this system, which look, the avalanches which correspond to instabilities look fundamentally different depending on whether you have sand or glass beads because of this difference in the rheology. And it is, I have heard nobody, including myself, come up with any plausible reason at all for this fundamental difference in the behavior of sand, which are non-spherical rough particles, and glass beads, which are smoother, although presumably still rough on some scale, particles. Okay? So, even aside from that comment, which is kind of meant to flesh out my observation on my kind of devil in the details sermon over here, this is a remarkable formula. Why? Well, let's suppose we're sitting up here deep in the steady state flow region. And we want to know what's the velocity, what is the kind of effective viscosity of the system given the forcing that it's under that determines what the flow is. That velocity, and thus that effective viscosity, is determined by the position of the h-stop of theta line, and thus of the basically the thickness of the flow that where it would stop. So somehow, a flow that's 200 particles deep knows that if it were only 15 particles deep, it would have to stop. And it uses that length scale to tell us what the Fruita number should be. So going back to this shortage of length scales problem, the system has solved this problem for us by picking out of the blue a length scale that seems to be relevant only someplace entirely different in the phase diagram of the system. Okay? Now, there is a growing theoretical literature on the subject of the Poulikin phase rule. I don't want to say to advertise this as a problem that nobody knows anything about, mainly because that would be personally embarrassing since I'm the author of some of that theoretical literature. The theoretical explanation that we have been, let's see, now I have the old corner of the blackboard problem. I think I will try to do it over here. The basic explanation that we have advanced is one in which there's correlated motion, and the correlated motion defines a length scale L, which is basically kind of a Prandtl mixing length for the granular system. And this length scale is basically controlling both the viscosity in the flowing steady state flowing regime, as well as the criterion, the thresholding criterion for the initiation of the flow. So it's a kind of standard fluid dynamics approach applied in a somewhat new regime which seems to account for some of the seemingly paradoxical features of the Pulley-Kent flow rule. Now, if you analyze in terms of the inelastic collapse of the particles, whether the sizes of the regions in which you might see correlated motion, you actually find that the size of those regions is basically determined by square root of the pressure divided by the density times 1 over the shear root. Okay? So, and this goes into the full theoretical machinery that tries to recover the Pulley-Kent phase rule. Okay? So this is fine. But then the question arises, can we go further than the shoot flow picture with this kind of reasoning? So there, I have to refer to a recent work by a corporate author, corporate in the sense not of connected with industry, but corporate in the sense of more than one. The corporate author is called GDR Nidi, Groupe de Recherche Nidi, although a number of them actually live in Paris, so I don't know why Paris is now part of the Nidi. And what GDR Nidi have claimed in a very lengthy recent paper is that a variety of flows, not only free surface flows such as chute flows, but also confined flows, can be understood in terms of the behavior of a scaling variable, which is gamma dot divided by the square root of p over rho, which in the Prandtl mixing length theory is just basically the diameter of the particle divided by the mixing. So, this is actually a rather optimistic picture. It suggests that perhaps we have figured out what's the right length scale on which to build our granular fluid dynamics, and we might be in a position to unify various different types of flows, which have typically been approached by rather different phenomenological strategies. And you'll note that I have not altered, I've not cheated on my statement that there is a shortage of length scales, because the pressure in these systems is either imposed by the boundaries or else it's determined by gravity, in which case the characteristic pressure is determined by the characteristic length scale in the system. So this is really using boundary information to build a length scale inside the system. In the interest of honesty, I should say that GDR Meade's paper is an experimental paper. So I read it and was positively impressed, but Jerry came up to me right before the talk and was not really complaining, but observing that they emphasize rather more the similarities between a wide class of experiments that they are dealing with than they emphasize the dissimilarities. So I think probably we're going to have to need to have a serious experimental critique of the work of GDR Meade before we know whether or not this is really the advance that it seems to be. Okay, so that's the liquid physics example. And now I'd like to proceed to a more solid state example, which is granular packings. This is up. Okay, so I start out with a classic argument, which has a long prehistory, was used in different contexts by Shlomo Alexander in the 80s, but was introduced into the field of granular physics more or less at the time of the last KITP program on granular physics by Sam Edwards, which is the following. Suppose you have a packing of particles, P, that is in mechanical equilibrium. What constraints can we derive on the average coordination number z? Of such a packet. Okay? Well, if the packing is in mechanical equilibrium, then the total number of forces determined by the total number of contacts in the system must be greater than or equal to the number of degrees of freedom in the system, or you will not be able to fix all of the forces in such a way that there's no motion in the packet. So the total number of forces is equal to 1/2 the coordination number times the total number of particles in the system, basically because this counts the total number of contacts in the system, times the total number of forces exerted each contact, which is 1 normal and V minus 1 transverse forces. And the total number of, the reason I have my piece of paper is because I tend to forget that degrees of freedom I write as nv rather than nf, which is the natural way, which creates a lot of confusion. Okay, so the number of degrees of freedom is the number of particles times d translational and 1/2 d times d minus 1 rotational degrees of freedom per particle. Okay. So from this, you easily conclude that you need z greater than or equal to v plus 1 in order to have a mechanically stable packing. Okay? So, actually, this is actually a kind of funny argument in a lot of ways. I'd like to make two comments on it. The first is that the if this were exactly true, if the number of degrees of freedom were exactly equal to the number of forces in the system, we would be in a situation that's called an isostatic packing, in which the forces are uniquely determined by the requirement that the packing be at rest. So that's a rather nice case, because you can forget about contact mechanics, you know, what's the compliance of the contact, what's the history of loading of the contacts, of all of that kind of stuff, because the geometry is determining the forces. So that rather simple case has exerted a hypnotic influence on the field, precisely because a lot of the things that I told you for 15 minutes one needs to worry about, one in fact does not need to worry about in those situations. Unfortunately, the numerical evidence is that when you pack these systems, you typically do not get isostatic packings, at least with frictional particles. So we're back in the soup of having to worry about all of that stuff. Okay? In general, if you look at packings, the volume fraction on a stable packing is typically between the number that's about 0.55 in three dimensions, which is called random loose packing, and about 0.64, which is random close packing. And depending on how you prepare the system, you can get volume values of the packing fraction anywhere in between these two numbers. And that raises the natural question of what actually is controlling the packing fraction in any particular experiment. And I'll tell you about one of those experiments, which actually David Dean was telling us about earlier this week, but it's also a very famous experiment, also done around the time, a little bit after, I think, the last KITP workshop or program on the subject. And what Nowak et al., which is Chicago group, did was they took a cylindrical bed of particles and they capped it from the bottom. And they capped it with an acceleration, say in units of g, that they would vary over the course of the experiment. And what they saw was something rather remarkable. They saw that as a function of gamma, the amplitude of the tapping, that there were irreversible and reversible wave means. So they saw values a little bit higher than 0.65, either because of the polydispersity of their particles, which is good, or because they saw surface ordering near the walls, which is kind of worrying about the validity of the experiment. But they would start with a particular value, and then as they tapped it, when you tap, working with the coffee can in the kitchen in the morning, if you tap a granular material, its volume fraction increases, and then at a certain point, they would go onto a reversible line and then stay on that line. So that it appears that the volume fraction in this experiment is a state function once you reach the reversible line of the tapping amplitude gamma. This observation reawakened interest which had been somewhat dormant. In what is known as the Edwards hypothesis. I will finish in 5 minutes. So, the Edwards hypothesis is that under certain circumstances, which Edwards didn't bother to define and which the rest of us have spent 15 years trying to figure out, the probability of if alpha corresponds to a jammed state, which incidentally, VAM just means in mechanical equilibrium. There's no mysticism about the word. The probability of being in that state is given by exponential of minus the volume of that state divided by a parameter x divided by the sum over all such states of e to the minus v alpha over x. So this is very much by analogy with statistical mechanics. You have a temperature-like variable called x, which should characterize a particular system. So for instance, it would depend on the tapping amplitude gamma. Once you fix that, you have various possible volumes of packings. So this implies, for instance, that the probability for the state to be in any particular packing that has the same volume is exactly identical, as in the case of energy and statistical mechanics. Okay, and the temperature-like parameter x is called the compactivity. And we're basically saying here, like the temperature, if the compactivity is large, then you have a system that doesn't care enormously about what its value of V alpha should be, and it's going to be much more controlled by the density of states, how many systems there are with that, jam systems there are with that value of V. Whereas as you lower the compactivity, you're going to be driven more and more into the denser states, regardless of how many of them there are. Okay. So, there is now a small industry of people trying to understand in detail this and how to connect this statement with experiments and what's the right way to confront this hypothesis with experiments. And that's actually proved to be a rather difficult program. I'd just like to mention that there is, this is actually a rather remarkable hypothesis, and it would be very surprising if it were true. Let's consider the full phase space of the system. And so I'm not going to take rigid particles. I'm going to take particles that have a finite Young's modulus so that the full phase space is accessible. And we have jammed states in this phase space. And then we have, under the dynamics of the system, domains of attraction for each jammed state. And then what Edwards is saying, for instance, in the case of this experiment, is if you bang the thing, so you randomize to some extent your position in this space, and then you let it relax, i.e. flow into one of the jammed states, say your probability of flowing into that jam state, which is the probability that you started out right after the tap in the domain of attraction of that jam state, is a function only of the volume of that jam state. Okay? I personally don't believe it's true. It seems to me to be an extremely strong statement about the dynamics of the system that one could almost prove is untrue. However, that doesn't mean it's not useful, because it might be very close to being true, or it might be close enough that this developing thermodynamics of packings could actually be useful in computing the properties of packing. But I would just like to state that the there's a major open problem, which I think David Dean is also interested in working on, which is to construct model systems in which one can actually understand the structure of this phase space and understand the circumstances under which an Edwards hypothesis is true or approximately true. Okay, this is not a complete review of the subjects to be addressed in the workshop or program. As you've already realized, I'm sure, this is a somewhat centrifugal field, simply because we try to deal with problems of gases, problems of solids, problems of fluids. You know, really everything that we have in not just in condensed matter physics, but in dilute matter physics, which, I mean, I don't think that if I propose to have a KIPP program on condensed and dilute matter physics, I don't think I would get very far. And the only thing that unifies it is that we're always talking about these different states for grains. So I think it is a centrifugal field, and we have to accept that. But there are a number of other areas of focus over the next few weeks, including kinetics of granular gases, the other kinds of thermodynamic analogies, which are analogies between jamming transitions, which such as, for instance, the transitions that occur here, and disordered phase transitions, such as lattice or spin lattice transitions. The very important problem, which I touched on, of suspensions, which are, you know, really what in my industry brought us into this problem in the first place, and the dynamics of suspensions and geophysical flows. Geophysical flows are interesting in that the volume fraction is not fixed, as it normally is in physics systems, but it's basically determined by the response of the system to its boundary conditions. And colloidal regimes as well, where you start to put back temperature as a parameter in the system, and there is an interesting compare and contrast to be done between colloidal and granular physics. Thank you for your attention.
I'd like to ask about the surplus hypothesis.
Right.
So according to this formula, the most probable configuration corresponds to volume equal to zero, right?
Yeah, except the density of states isn't there.
Huh?
The density, you could say the same thing about classical statistical mechanics. The most probable energy is negative infinity, it's just there are no states down there.
You mean it should be multiplied by density of states in this formula?
This is the probability of occupation of a single state. So if you want, for instance, to know the average value of the velocity of the volume, you can involve this with the density of states. Yes?
In the Chicago experiment, you talked about the tapping amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
What about the frequency?
What they did was they wanted the system to completely relax between taps. So this frequency was a single sine wave pulse at 30 hertz. So basically 1/30th of a second. And then they would wait in between the taps an amount of time, which if they waited long enough, their results didn't depend on that amount of time between the taps. No question.
Yes. The experiment is that it somehow, if you went to a lower amplitude, having achieved equilibrium in a tighter packing, that the stuff will expand?
This is contracting. This is the volume fraction, which if I wrote,
Hit it harder for a while, and you get very compact
thing.
And if you hit more
softly,
you said this.
No. You're making a sine error. Lower phi is less compact.
Yeah, no, I'm happy with that. But suppose you've achieved something that
If I achieve...
0.65.
Right.
And you've got a reversible curve up there.
Oh, absolutely. So what this says is that if I take the coffee can...
Yeah.
And I tap it slowly for a long time, tap it softly for a long time so that I get here, and then I start to tap it hard, then it actually gets fluffier. You're absolutely right.
I've never seen that in the kitchen.
Okay, yes, I mean, I wouldn't have a, you know, kitchen messes across Santa Barbara.
I have a question concerning this M&M problem.
Yes.
What's the hype about it? I mean, isn't it, if you think of spheres or and discs or elongated so cylinders, mm-hmm. then I would always suspect that the packing of spheres or is less than the that of cylinders or discs.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the...
Well, I mean, I don't know, you know, the statements that results are not interesting or not extremely interesting because they are what one would have expected them to be are subjective. There were enough people who either had the other expectation or didn't have strong expectations and were surprised by this that it created some interest. The other piece, which is a little bit deeper, and it's objective, is that if you look at these kinds of arguments for particles that are not spherical, in the case of friction particles, there was nothing here that needed the particle to be a sphere. When you make these arguments for frictionless particles, you find that whether you have a sphere or you don't have a sphere is important because it affects the degree to which you can generate torques from normal forces. So as the density of the packing goes up, the number of nearest neighbors is also going up. And in fact, one remarkable result of the Torquato simulations, which I think there may be some problems with the Torquato simulations, but largely they seem to reproduce a lot of the features of the experiments, is that the coordination numbers are extremely high for random packing. Coordination numbers are close to 10, which is what you would expect for frictionless ellipsoids, but the M&Ms are actually frictional particles. So there seems to be, and the density is the same, so you suspect that in the experiment the coordination number is about 10 too. So that it creates this kind of mystery which hasn't been resolved of why are frictional ellipsoids behaving more like frictionless ellipsoids in terms of their packing. Yes.
I don't quite understand your statement about the phenomenology. One can at least dream that, say, in the context of this granular hydrodynamics, mm-hmm. there would be some sort of phenomenological equation which, in addition to the usual hydrodynamic variables, would have some other variable. Degree of compaction, you know, the history dependent, whatnot.
Some new state variables.
One would introduce enough state variables.
Right.
To so, do these things exist? Are you saying that they're not very universal in the sense that each flow geometry requires its own phenomenological equation?
I mean,
people have said that engineers are better than physicists at doing it, so mm-hmm. does it just mean that they've solved the problem, there is some phenomenological equation that...
Well, I mean, there are phenomenological equations that are used in engineering practice for every granular flow situation that appears in technology. And they, you know, work well enough so that the technologies that are based on them work as well.
I'm not understanding something. So does it mean that if I'm interested in shoot flow in some sort of semicircular shoot as opposed to an inclined plane, I need different phenomenological equation?
Well, you will. In practice, yes. I mean, there will be ad hoc assumptions made about typically about things like friction with the wall. and, you know, geometry factors that come in that when you analyze them, you know, are difficult to understand from the physics point of view.
So the statement is there is no phenomenology which would describe granular hydrodynamics in a geometry independent.
I would say that's correct. I mean, there isn't for fluid mechanics either.
Tom, just to be clear, when you say there is no phenomenology that's microscopic phenomenology independent, that's the same as the current state of play or as projection forward?
That's the current state of play. I do not make statements about the future. Past performance is no guarantee of future results.
Well, I think we'll end up. Thanks for sharing some of those sticky issues.